Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
Welcome to another episode of Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Helvarg, and my co-host, Vicki Nichols-Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, is joining us from yet another continent, Africa this time. Hi, Vicki.
Hi there, and greetings, everyone.
The Washington Post and a number of other media outlets recently reported on the discovery of the bacteria responsible for sea star wasting disease that wiped out almost all the starfish on the West Coast over 12 years ago. That in turn contributed to the collapse of a number of kelp forests. This discovery is a major breakthrough, as you can't help to treat a disease till you know what causes it. Our guest today, Drew Harvell, is a longtime professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at Cornell, who more recently joined us here on the West Coast. Her research on the health and sustainability of marine ecosystems has taken her all over the world, along with many scientific papers and honors. She's also produced several award-winning books, including A Sea of Glass, Ocean Outbreak, and her most recent book, The Ocean's Menagerie. Not surprisingly, she and a number of her former students and colleagues were the team that unlocked the mystery of the Dead Sea Stars. So, welcome, Drew. Before we get into all that, when did you first get interested in the ocean?
Hi, David and Vicki. Thanks so much for having me on. I grew up in New Hampshire, where we've only got about 13 miles of coastline. But as a child, I was fascinated with both oceans and frogs in streams. And it was a natural evolution to be able to first work for a consulting company on ocean issues and then continue my studies as in invertebrate biodiversity at the very beginning.
I hate to say it takes up a lot of backbone to break into a field like that, but it was probably challenging in terms of just being a woman in science and also being in a field that didn't have a lot of acknowledgement. You helped sort of grow the field in a way.
Well, that I'm still recovering from your not having a backbone issue, but I don't know. It didn't feel hard at the time. It just felt like such a joy to spend time diving and just reveling in the joy of invertebrate biodiversity and body designs. I had an incredible amount of opportunity and really exciting, cool things to do as a diver, and especially through my studies at Friday Harbor Labs, which I think of as just a mecca for invertebrate biology and a place where we have unusually high biodiversity. And so I guess maybe things were hard now and then, but I was pretty fortunate and having a lot of great opportunity. Probably the biggest thing that happened to me was when Tom Sikonik invited me to be an aquanaut on his project in St. Croix, because I'd been working as a diver at Friday Harbor Labs, and they needed another diver. And so I got invited along to be part of this incredible expedition that lived underwater for an entire week, at 60 feet on the bottom of the sea in St. Croix, and working on coral reef projects there.
So from that point on, how did you move through your choices to get your advanced degree and move on to some of the more exciting stuff of this sea star wasting syndrome and some of the information that you've collected about other types of challenges within the ocean?
I was pretty fortunate, again, because as a graduate student, I was at the University of Washington doing most of my thesis work at Friday Harbor Labs. And I finished that up and was successful in getting an international postdoc working with George Mackey at University of Victoria in Canada. But he came to do his work at Friday Harbor. So we were working on some chemical ecology of bryozoans and nudibranchs. And that was really cool. But then at the same time, I interviewed for a job at Cornell and they gave it to me. So I was hired as an assistant professor of invertebrate biology pretty soon after I finished my PhD and joined the faculty at Cornell University, which I remained there for my entire career. It was just a fabulous, fabulous place, even though you're thinking, How did you end up in upstate New York as a marine biologist? How did that work?
I can understand.
Yeah, but it did work because it was given complete freedom.
Cornell is well known for its studies of nutrient runoff into the oceans, and then you became a popular source of information on the oceans in general. I think with other guests we've had, other scientist guests like Sylvia Earle and Nancy Knowlton and Steve Palumbi, you decide to share this wealth of knowledge of the ocean through your writing. And I think it's interesting, your first book, A Sea of Glass. Tell us about how you got inspired to write that book.
When I came to Cornell, my expertise, whatever greatness I had, was as a field biologist and working with living invertebrates. And so pretty soon after I got to Cornell, they asked me not only to be the curator of invertebrates, which I had already agreed to, but that this included this glass collection that was housed at Corning Museum of Glass, but was actually Cornell's collection. And so I just didn't know how to handle that. But the then chair, Paul Feeney, and I went down to take a look at it. And the moment I opened those boxes in this big warehouse and saw so many of my favorite invertebrates rendered exquisitely in glass, it was instantaneous. There was no turning back from that. And the Blaschka glass collection was created in the late 1800s by the father-son team, Rudolf and Leopold Blaschka, and was acquired by Cornell and is the largest Blaschka collection in the world with over 573 separate models, exquisitely rendered of particular invertebrate species, jellyfish, nudibranchs, sea anemones, all the very soft-bodied invertebrates that normally wouldn't, especially in that day, wouldn't preserve at all. And so it was a teaching collection for Cornell. And now there are over 60 universities that have these. Anyway, so I agreed to do this and set about restoring parts of our damaged collection and bringing it back to campus. But as I gave talks, I always wanted to talk about the beauty of the living animals. And so very quickly started showing videos. And then one of my colleagues said, let's make a movie. And so we started doing dives to go back and find the exact matches to the Blaschka invertebrates, using the collection as kind of a time capsule, because we're the 573 models that they created for us in 1880 still in our oceans of today. And so that was really the starting point for that book, A Sea of Glass. And that book was just a fabulous adventure. And a lot of the places we were working around the world, like Indonesia, Palau, Australia, as well as the Atlantic Offshore's Marine Lab, to try to find and film the living matches, and then to sort of talk about their biology. But in that way, I kind of used the glass as ambassadors for ocean biodiversity. And so many people who really were kind of scared or nervous about seeing a live invertebrate in the ocean, somehow that, I don't know, a sort of a Jules Verne fear of some of these things. When they saw them crafted in glass, it just translated into beauty and wonder. And I continue to this day to love to give those talks. It's been a wonderful project.
Well, art really does do that. It helps to translate science to ocean, to different landscapes, biodiversity. And sometimes art really can penetrate people's fears or anxieties and really encourage them to open up their hearts, which then allows them to get more interested and want to be educated about the ecosystems. And we can actually transform people from anti-scared ocean to ocean lovers. So art really plays a powerful role, for sure.
That's exactly it, Vicky. And I mean, people said that directly to me. They said, I was scared to be in the ocean and see those things, but after hearing your talk and looking at the glass, I wanted to go out and learn more about them. And I'm like, my job is done.
Yay.
That's it. Yeah.
Did you find many of the species that you were looking for when you began your exploration?
So I really thought we were going to find a lot of them missing or gone. And actually, we've found most of them. And so It's been a really sort of an interesting journey, and I talk about it in the book, but partly I think it's because they did choose a lot of very common invertebrates and sort of hardy ones, intertidal ones, shallow water ones. And then also it's kind of hard to verify if something's missing, especially for an invertebrate in the ocean. So there are a few that we can't find, but we can't really document that they're not there. But of course, the story is nuanced in that there are a lot of the models that are now very rare or endangered in our oceans. Particularly, there's a whole group of Mediterranean invertebrates that have been quite endangered by heat warming events. And so some of the cold water corals and anemones in those waters are vastly diminished. But I still take it as hopeful, even though it makes me sad they're diminished, that we still have them. We have such riches and beauty in our ocean.
And I think, you know, it's that balance of wonder and warning that really is critical to educating the public about our changing seas. You wrote in 2019, you were part of a paper that showed how this sea star wasting disease was dramatically expanded by the warming seas. Maybe you can talk a little about how the ocean is changing and how that's impacting life in the seas.
Yeah, a lot of our research projects, David, are focused around work on ecologically important species. We call them foundation species if they're corals or seagrasses, or maybe keystone species in the case of starfish. And so it's a kind of a remarkable thing to me that all of those ecologically important players are affected by serious infectious diseases that are increased under warming events. And so first we worked on coral health for many years all around the world as part of a World Bank project on coral sustainability, trying to find ways to bolster the resilience of coral reefs and study the infectious diseases as well as bleaching that were causing and continue to cause big destruction on our reefs. And then back in Friday Harbor, we noticed that some of the seagrasses, they're called eelgrass in our waters, were having lesions on them. And so we started studying that protist-caused disease and found that was also related with warming. And so in the last 12 years, we've witnessed huge declines in our eelgrass meadows, particularly in sort of northern waters, but in the San Juan Islands, caused by heat-associated disease outbreaks in our foundation species, the eelgrass, which is one of the most important of all our habitats. It helps provide clean water and habitat and nursery areas for fishes. And then in 2013, for me as a disease ecologist, just the biggest shock of all, when we had a large-scale epidemic of sea stars that affected over 20 species. So a big part of our biodiversity. And then, an unprecedented scale from San Diego all the way to Alaska. And so just to make a long, long, long story a lot shorter, we pretty quickly found out that amidst a lot of large-scale mortality in different species, there was one that really stood out as being impacted badly, and that was the sunflower star. And this is an endemic species. It lives only on our coast, and it's the largest star in the world with a diameter the size of a bicycle tire and 24 arms.
Up to 13 pounds, the weight of a bald eagle.
Right? Are you kidding me? I mean, that's amazing. And this big power player was the most susceptible. So a menace underwater, but just taken down by the smallest thing of all. And so as a disease ecologist, I was pretty obsessed with wanting, we needed to know what the cause was. And so again, after 12 years, 2 weeks ago, we released the paper describing the results of experiments to show that the main killer is this bacterium, Vibrio pectinacida. And I want to completely acknowledge the huge collaboration. The Nature Conservancy supported our research. The Hakai Institute supported a postdoc that was part of the project. It was a large international effort led by Dr. Alyssa Gaiman and postdoc Melanie Prentice, but also with collaborators in Curtis Suttle's lab at UBC. And it was pretty exciting that the science in this paper we just released is so strong because all of the molecular work supported the presence of that pathogen in sick and wasting stars. In the challenge experiments that we did, all of the stars always died when they were exposed to that agent. But the thing that is just so exciting to me is that one of our colleagues, Amy Chan, was able to get the bacterium into culture. And so Melanie Prentice and Alyssa Gaiman were able to actually test the pure culture in challenge experiments and show that it really did very rapidly kill those stars. And so it's an example of some really strong science.
Do you love the salty characters and ocean champions we have on The Rising Tide? So do we, and we're dedicated to bringing inspiring stories and voices that make waves. But here's the catch. We need your support to keep the tide rolling. A tax-deductible donation at bluefront.org will help keep The Rising Tide on the air and online. If you're ready and able to amplify these salty voices for the sea, dive in with a donation, big or small. Visit bluefront.org and join the movement. And now, back to the show.
I think we associate spinelessness with like our Congress. It's got a negative connotation. And so we'd love to hear more about what are the superpowers of sea stars and other invertebrates.
Yeah, well, this new book, The Ocean's Menagerie, grew out of just my abiding appreciation and amazement, really, at the biology and the feats biologically that various marine invertebrates are capable of. And for the sea stars, it's their weird skin. They're capable of instantly cross-linking proteins to make their skin stiff at the firing of a neuron, and then just as quickly uncross-linking and making their skin slack. And so this allows them, for example, to autotomize or drop their arms. And so, but making the skin stiff is what allows them the holding power for opening clams. And then, of course, it was amazing that amidst all these powers, that one of the smallest things in the ocean, the bacterium, could take down sort of this mighty predator. And so I talk about that a fair bit.
You've described this term I don't think many of our listeners are familiar with, and that is pathogen pollution. And it is a growing problem. Can you give us more information on that? You know, we've looked at so many different problems in the ocean, diseases. Take us a step further.
We may not think of it all the time, but the oceans are technically downstream of land. And so anything that we introduce on land is going to wash into the oceans. And so, for example, some of the diseases of otters have their basis in cats on land and that then wash into the ocean and then, you know, cause our marine life to be ill. So there are also quite a few examples of conveyance of pathogens from aquaculture, from sort of nearshore aquaculture, either close by on land or in the ocean, washing into to wild organisms in nature. And so all of those would be cases of pathogen pollution where there's a virus or a bacterium or a fungus or a protist. We have a lot of things that we call pathogens that can be washing downstream. And then think about it. I talk about this a lot in my book, Ocean Outbreak. We do not have the tools in managing our oceans to control pathogens once they're, you know, widely dispersed in marine waters. So we can't quarantine, we can't cull, and for most cases, we can't vaccinate. And so it makes the detection and the stoppage of any introduction really important in ocean ecosystems.
And so you had the example in Florida of a soil bacteria that was common in tomato fields, ending up impacting coral species down in the Florida Keys. Or as you say, the pathogens contained in cat poo in Monterey Bay. And there's a scientist I met who did a 5-year study where she identified that 70% of the cat feces that ended up in the water was from domestic cats that were let outdoors, not ferals. And I just thought, what commitment to science to spend 5 years studying cat poo? But it has meaning.
And it's also flushed down the toilets, when you think of the cat litter, and we don't have the capability at our water quality stations or our septic systems and our sewage systems to pull those pathogens out. So they not only go out from the wild cats, but they're also going down our drains.
So don't flush your kitty litter. That's an important lesson. I think people are most familiar with oil spills and oil pollution. Increasingly, people understand plastic pollution. There's all sorts of chemical pollution, DDT Superfund sites off California, and nutrient pollution. We've had Nancy Rabelais on the show, and she's kind of been called the mother of the dead zone, which she doesn't like. But she popularized the fact that all these farm chemicals come down the Mississippi and grow the second crop of algae in the Gulf of Mexico. Bacteria suck the oxygen out of the water while feeding on them, and you have these dead zones. So people are learning that, you know, what comes out of our farms and sewer systems, the nutrients can feed these harmful algal blooms. But the idea of pathogen pollution, that the other runoff is literally viruses and bacteria that are coming from the land into the ocean because of our built up coasts and our lack of preventative work and knowledge. And let me just talk a little about what pathogen pollution means in the larger ocean context.
It's just allowing either human bacteria and viruses can also get into the oceans and get transmitted to, for example, to marine mammals. I think aquaculture is kind of one of the bigger potential risks if it's not done well. And one of the cases I make in Ocean Outbreak is that we could be a lot more forward-looking and thinking about natural mechanisms for reducing the pathogens that get in our ocean. For example, some of our work that we've been pursuing and we continue to work on actually is showing that inside seagrass meadows, there tend to be lower levels of bacteria. We started that work in Indonesia. It showed dramatically lower levels of human pathogenic bacteria that came in sewage were lower in seagrass meadows, and the coral health was higher in seagrass meadows. So we were able to talk about the one health concept that both human health and environmental or wildlife health can be connected. We felt that we should investigate that in domestic waters to make the case that it wasn't just in international places where the waters were dirty and something like seagrass could help. So we actually repeated a version of that study in Puget Sound and showed that mussels that were grown in seagrass meadows had fewer bacterial pathogens than those that were grown outside. And so I continue to really like this idea that we can find ways to make our nearshore waters healthier, even amidst this occasional uncontrollable rain of pathogens that may come from land or our rivers. We've also shown in corals that the plastics that create cuts and wounds in the coral skin can also be conveying infectious diseases. So it's a big problem, and there are a lot of ways we could be managing it. Yeah.
So I haven't read yet, but look forward to reading your latest book, Ocean's Menagerie, which I gather is not just the wonder of how all these species function, these inverts, but also how nature and these animals can help us in reducing our own problems, you know, take us back from the edge we've created.
I was fortunate in my early work as an assistant professor at Cornell to work with natural products chemists, where we were on cruises in the Caribbean searching out pharmaceutically useful drugs that could be developed from the sea. And our number one hit rate was sponges. And so one of the chapters of my book, I talk about the incredible biodiversity of really complicated biologically active chemicals that are being found in sponges. And one of the examples I give is mitomycin, which comes actually from one of our resident sponges, a halicondria on our shoreline. And sometimes when I give talks, people will raise their hands and say, hey, I'm on that drug. It's really an important one for bladder cancer. And so that is just the tiniest example of the huge number of particularly cancer drugs that have been discovered, and some of which are actually in either clinical trials or actual use. And then the wonder of that is that in many cases, those actual chemicals are made by bacteria living in the sponges. And so that's where the science comes in, to understand that dance of interaction between something like a sponge, which appears to be the home of the chemical, and the actual chemist making the chemical, which are the bacteria living in them. So one of the examples of, you know, really useful things to us are the drugs coming out of sponges and other marine organisms. I love to also talk about the discovery of bioluminescence in jellyfish, and that work was done at Friday Harbor Labs. Osama Shimomura discovered the chemicals that were actually causing light in jellyfish. And the cool part about that story is there's two different ones, aquarin and green fluorescent protein. Aquarin flashes blue, and green fluorescent protein flashes green. And not only is it a cool story about how he actually discovered those chemicals, but they eventually won a Nobel Prize for the green fluorescent protein because it is such a valuable biomedical tool. It is used in all kinds of biomedical research, particularly neurobiology, as a fluorescent marker. It's kind of a probe that shows up green when it's introduced.
So jelly is glowing with health for us as well. And Vicky, of course, is founder of the Inland Ocean Coalition, understands and tells the story that saving the ocean is also about saving us.
Absolutely.
So when you imagine a future with thriving marine life and all the work that you've done, what does that ocean look like to you?
That ocean just looks biodiverse. It's packed full. It's like a Ray Troll art image with very high biodiversity, and everything's healthy.
And check out our interview with Ray Troll.
Okay. Yeah. Well, he's one of my favorite artists. One of these days, I hope he'll do an invertebrate picture that looks like his fabulous fish pictures. So
they are great, with bioluminescence as well, so flashing purple and green. This has been a great interview, and thank you so much, Dr. Drew Harvell, professor at Cornell and author of many books, including her latest, The Ocean's Menagerie, for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Vicky and David, for having me. It was a pleasure, and I'm really delighted to be part of this.
Thank you for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review or share it with your friends and other ocean lovers. Follow us on Instagram and visit bluefront.org for more updates and additional resources. Rising Tide is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by David Helvark and me, Vicki Nichols-Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin, and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Cape May. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay hopeful and stay salty.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear, it's true. It's the Blue Frontier. Tear, tear. Off in the salty ocean, off to the Blue Frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky. There you are. Good boy, Sparky.